From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in the East Bay, Hercules, California, USA, planet Earth.
Coming up, we'll hear what it's like for a child to lose a parent to the criminal justice system.
It was like concentrated chaos for a long time. It's like you trying to conceal a grenade and it's finna explode, but it don't.
Then we'll sit down with local author Nell Bernstein to talk about why she thinks it's time to shut down the juvenile prison system altogether.
Being locked up as a kid is the greatest predictor that any individual will go on to become an adult prisoner.
And we'll meet a young San Francisco singer whose music is inspired by the past.
My music has a very old school West Coast flavor to it. Like, everybody tells me I sound like back in the 90s before I was born.
That's all coming up next on Cross Currents. More than 2 million children across the country have at least one parent behind bars. 16-year-old Kaimani Baxter is one of them.
It's been like 13 years since I've seen him. So I ain't hugged my dad since I was like 3 or 4 years old or touched him. I haven't touched him since I was 4 years old.
Baxter lives in San Leandro. Nearly 1 in 10 children in California have a parent in the criminal justice system. But local numbers are hard to come by. Experts say that's because most agencies don't keep data about the children of people they process into the criminal justice system. Author and longtime youth advocate Nell Bernstein says we should be keeping better track of these statistics.
It's really no different than any other loss of a parent in terms of the depth of the trauma and the longing, except that it's not only unrecognized, but actually stigmatized.
With so many people now being released from prison because of realignment, Bernstein says it's more important than ever to support children and families of the incarcerated. KALW's Kyungjin Lee has more on that ongoing story.
So, our checking question?
Oh, yeah. Hey, Mikey. Our checking question today is, how was your day and what do you feel about the subject of race today? Like, racism today.
About racism?
About a dozen teens take turns talking in a circle in a downtown Oakland church. Some snack on chips. Others sometimes snap their fingers in agreement with a speaker.
Humans tend to fear things that they don't know about. And that's just a human trait.
The group is called Project What, and it meets weekly. It's peer part support, part leadership development, and part advocacy for youth who have a parent in the criminal justice system. Everyone here has that in common. After check-ins, they get ready to watch a movie.
If everybody can sit that way, you remember the rules for videos, like no phones out, you need to pay
attention. Zoe Wilmot coordinates Project What, which stands for We Are Here and Talking. She's also a past participant of the program. She says it provided her a space to talk about how her mom's incarceration affected her.
Even growing up in a family where it was talked about with adults, I never had that space with other youth until I found Project What.
Wilmot's mom was locked up when she was 4 years old. She says while she loved having a relationship with her mom, visiting a prison still left Wilmot scarred.
It was hard to go to. It was stressful. I cried a lot. I had nightmares about being in prison all the time.
Nell Bernstein says these kids are the invisible victims of the criminal justice system.
These kids are going through a loss similar perhaps to having a parent in the military. But instead of the community rallying around them, they often feel they have to keep it secret.
Bernstein coordinates a San Francisco coalition that advocates for children of incarcerated parents.
I had met kids who spent as much as 6 weeks alone in an empty apartment after their parent was arrested. Then there were also kids who were unnecessarily taken in the back of a police car to a children's shelter when grandma was right down the street.
Bernstein says there's too little sympathy for incarcerated parents. She commonly hears, bad people don't deserve to have kids. But she says, people rarely see the issue through the child's perspective.
Who knows if there's people who don't deserve to have kids in or out of prison, but I haven't met a kid who doesn't deserve to have a parent.
So in 2003, Bernstein's organization created a Bill of Rights for Children of the Incarcerated. It includes points such as the right to visit and touch a parent, the right to be involved in decisions made about them, and the right not to be blamed for their parents' incarceration.
How you doing? Thanks for coming down.
Mm-hmm.
How you been?
I'm good.
Yeah, right?
Kaimani Baxter was 4 years old when his dad was arrested. Baxter wasn't home when the police came.
But I remember I came home and everything was like wrecked.
He only has a few memories of life with his dad, but he does remember what life was like after he left.
It was like concentrated chaos for a long time. It's like you trying to conceal a grenade, but you know the grenade is there, like, and it's finna explode, but it don't.
Baxter's dad is still in prison. Baxter grew up with his mom and big brother Carrie until a few years ago when Carrie was shot and killed. But Baxter doesn't lament on these losses. He says his situation is not unique.
It's regular. I mean, it's a few people that I know that don't have a relative that's in jail. And I count them on my fingers.
So most people you know have somebody who they love.
Hell yeah. Majority, yeah.
But he says no one talks about it openly.
When people are in jail, like, it's out of sight, out of mind. So yeah, I don't think nobody thinks about it.
Everybody.
At Project What's weekly meeting, the students settle in to watch the film. It's about racial inequity in the criminal justice system. Zoe Wilmot, coordinator of the youth group, says movies like this are really just meant to get the kids to tell their own stories. And that's what can lead to real change. When Wilmot shared her experience about visiting her mom at a conference, an official from Solano County realized what it was like to go through the jail's visiting room as a kid.
Now there's like toys for kids and murals and safer spaces for kids to feel like they can interact with their parent without the guards being right there.
That kind of support for families is becoming important outside of jail as well. Under California's Prison Realignment Plan, almost 20,000 former inmates are back in their communities. Many are reuniting with their families and adjusting to life after incarceration. Advocate Nell Bernstein says this transition can be hard on kids.
Often when you're on probation, a probation officer can do an unannounced search, which can be terrifying to a child. There's also the uncertainty that your parent could disappear at any moment.
Law enforcement agencies have started to listen. For example, San Francisco is trying to insert children's perspectives before and after a parent is sentenced. But Bernstein says there's still no uniform policy or enforcement among different agencies. And she says that void means children are likely to continue to be invisible victims of the criminal justice system. For Cross Currents, I'm Kyung Jin Lee.
Many thanks to Kyung Jin Lee for bringing us that report. I'm now joined by Nell Bernstein, who we just heard in that last piece. Nell Bernstein is the coordinator of the San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents Partnership, and she's also the author of the new book, Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. So Nell, we just heard about the children of incarcerated people and how much the incarceration affects the entire family. And you've written extensively about the effects of incarceration on children whose parents are incarcerated. So since you started working on this, what, like 2 decades ago, I think it is now?
Around 2000.
Yeah. So what changes have you seen? What changes have been made to actually help kids? How is the system changing to be more sensitive to kids' needs?
Well, I think the first tremendous change that's happened is the children have become much more visible. I mean, a Google search in 2000 when I started looking at this revealed very few responses. But now there are programs, there's research, there's just a level of understanding that incarceration does affect the kids. And it's hard to grasp how much that was not the case before. How many kids I talked to who had been left behind in empty apartments.
Like their parents are arrested and the kids are just left there.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes they would come home after school and find an empty apartment. But sometimes police would just step over them. And police have talked about this, too. So visibility is the change I've seen nationally. And then most of the changes in how public systems deal with the kids have happened at the local level. That's what we do with SFCIP, the organization that you mentioned. And we organize our work around a Bill of Rights for children of incarcerated parents that's been picked up all across the country. And for us, it's really been a matter of establishing relationships with the police, the jail, but also public health, mental health, the school district we're now beginning to talk with, to increase awareness and begin to recognize the unique needs of these kids.
And what do you think, you know, obviously some progress has been made. What do you think we still need to work on in terms of really recognizing that when a parent is arrested, there's an innocent victim here, which is the kid who loses that parent?
Well, I think that, you know, we've made tremendous progress, for example, around the time of arrest. San Francisco just formalized a departmental general order that is excellent and I think is going to be used as a model for.
And what is that? What's the order, essentially?
Well, we spent a lot of time working with police and child welfare to balance it so that kids don't get left alone, but at the same time, they don't automatically get dropped off at the children's shelter if grandma is down the street and perfectly able to care for them. So the police and child welfare now work together. It acknowledges that just because you're arrested, you don't lose your parental rights immediately, which was not acknowledged before. There was a sense that who cares what they say? You know, they're being hauled off. And kids who were taken to the shelter often felt like they were being arrested. So it balances safety and psychic safety. And now we're moving into training so that officers really understand how they're perceived by children. I feel like we've also made tremendous progress with the jail. We've moved from window visiting for children, the glass and the telephones, which is just devastating, incomprehensible for young children, to a program that offers really high quality parenting education and contact visits. So those are the kinds of areas, and there's more than I can go into where progress has been made. I think that the real challenge is thinking about kids and families when we write laws that establish sentences and then when we impose individual sentences. I mean, that's really the elephant in the living room. We've made some progress in San Francisco. The probation department has implemented a family impact statement so that the paperwork they submit to the court by necessity includes some information about the kids. But I think we have a long way to go in including the impact on the next generation in our overall criminal justice policy.
And really incorporating that into the way that we do criminal justice. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Cross Currents, and we're speaking with Nell Bernstein, who's coordinator of the San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents Partnership. She's also the author of Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. And Nell, one of the really shocking and alarming things that we know statistically now is that if a child's parent has been incarcerated, the chances are so much higher that that child will have a run-in with the law as well. So what are some of the solutions to end this kind of domino effect, this cycle?
So that's a tricky one because that's both true and not true. For a long time, there was a statistic circulating that a child of an incarcerated parent was 6 times more likely to be incarcerated herself than her peers. Somebody finally sat me down with a calculator and showed me that given the high rate of incarceration, that was impossible. It would be more than 100%. I think the best way to put it is that children of incarcerated parents are more likely to get into trouble with the justice system if we do nothing, if we reach out to them in no way, if all the public systems that take control of their lives ignore them, then yes, they become extremely vulnerable children. But we don't have to do that. And I've seen so many families where one young person may go on to prison, the other is a mortgage broker. So I just feel like we also need to be careful about predetermination.
And so, Nell, your new book, Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison, is all about the incarceration of young people, many of whom did have parents who went through the system. And you talk about the system, you really studied it, and you said, you know, you went into this project of writing this book thinking that you would come out with some suggestions for reform. But what you really come out with is the idea that this is a broken system. Can you tell us why you think it's so broken?
Yeah, I mean, there were sort of two legs that conclusion stands on. One is the research. A kid who is incarcerated as a juvenile becomes twice as much likely as another kid who's committed the exact same acts, but for whatever reason doesn't get locked up, twice as likely to become an adult prisoner. So you have a system that is not only not helping, it's fostering the problem it's supposed to solve. So it's not just bad for kids, it's really endangering the public. That's one thing. The other thing is every kid I talked to, when I asked them what rehabilitated you, or for lack of a better word, what dehabilitated you, talked about relationships. The beginning of delinquency was almost always connected to some kind of grief or loss, the death of a grandmother, the incarceration of a father, and not getting support around that loss. And when they talked about coming out of delinquency, they always talked about a lasting connection with an adult they could trust. And you just really can't build those kinds of connections in a locked environment.
And basically what you've found in studying how we incarcerate young people is that the way that the prison system works is you're essentially severing the ties with their existing families, which is probably one of the most counterproductive things that you can do.
I mean, that's by definition what it does. It literally puts walls between kids and their families and kids and the rest of it.
But there are a lot of examples, I mean, particularly here locally, where that system is really changing.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's really promising, is that we've seen nationwide a 40% drop in the number of kids behind bars. And when you look at the California Youth Authority, we've gone from a system that held over 10,000 kids to one that has a few hundred now over the course of a little more than a decade. And that would have been inconceivable a decade ago. The question is, what are we replacing that system with? And my sense is that it really varies from county to county. San Francisco is at the forefront of coming up with community-based alternatives that recognize kids' needs for relationship with their family and also with other helping adults. In other counties, my sense is kids are just kind of being shunted into local juvenile halls.
But there's a lot that's going on here, say in San Francisco, that's really trying to, once you find out that a kid is either acting out or traumatizing somebody else or experiencing trauma, that they've got sort of community-based programs where people stay in their family, in their community, but are getting some help.
Yeah, and it's important that you use the word trauma, because the level of trauma that you see inside a locked facility is just, I mean, it's like walking into a trauma ward. And there are a number of organizations in San Francisco that are beginning to recognize that and take what's called a trauma-informed approach. The way I put it when I talked about it in the book is, you know, it's a question of asking not just what did you do, little criminal, but what happened to you to take you to this place. And San Francisco is getting much, much better at asking what happened to you and what do you need to heal from that.
And you also in the book really implicate all of us in this kind of growth of our juvenile justice system, of our juvenile prison system, because we have this notion that it's other kids, not my kid. But, you know, you talk about the vast majority of the kids that are there for these pretty minor infractions, not the major assault or murder.
Yeah, and especially those who enter for the first time. I do find there's a perception that to wear that jumpsuit and be locked in a cell, you have to at least commit a carjacking, if not, you
something
know,
much
a mass
more heinous,
murder.
Yeah.
But we're talking about graffiti. We're talking about, you know, in Los Angeles, police officers standing two blocks from the schools and giving truancy tickets to kids who were late, who were trying to go to school, which then turned into warrants and then would get them locked up. We're really talking about not just nonviolent offenses, but very low-level offenses. And we're also talking about tremendous inequities in who gets locked up for those offenses. I mean, overall, a black teenager is 4.5 times more likely not just to get locked up, but to get locked up for the identical act as his white counterpart. And I think that contributes to again, this idea that these are other kids. But, you know, California is, however you want to put it, a majority-minority state. And even if it weren't, I think that we like to think that we care for all children as our own. But incarcerating them makes them so invisible that it's very easy to comfort ourselves with myths.
And you say it also makes kids much more dangerous when they do eventually come out and come back into our community.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's the irony, is that what's good for kids is often pitted against public safety, but what's good for kids enhances public safety. Being locked up as a kid is the greatest predictor that any individual will go on to become an adult prisoner. So it's obviously working against its central aim.
Nell Bernstein is the author of Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. She's also coordinator of the San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents Partnership. You can hear a longer conversation about the effects of juvenile incarceration on our website, klw.org, and click on Your Call. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. For children in California, the Office of Health Planning reports that mental diseases and disorders are the largest cause of hospitalization for kids. Last week, New America Media held a community forum for advocates, clinicians, healthcare providers, young people, and media in San Francisco to address youth depression and how storytelling can help with feelings of isolation. From Youth Radio in Oakland, Raphael Johns reports.
Hi, I'm Sonia.
Many people talk about depression when they're feeling sad. But Sonia, who was on the youth panel, explained to a packed room that what she experiences is very different from feeling a bit down.
And I think of myself as a tool that breaks a lot, that a lot of the time I don't really work. I guess it makes me feel like I'm not what a person is supposed to be.
According to UCLA's Center for Health Policy Research, almost 20% of California youth, ages 12 to 17, reported needing help for emotional or mental health problems. In Alameda County, that number jumps up to 30%. But the help, or treatment, that young people receive isn't always what they're looking for. Someone who's trying to change that is Patrick Gardner, the executive director of the Young Minds Advocacy Project, a nonprofit organization that helps low-income youth and their families. He noted that many of the panelists had experienced problems within the mental health system.
For example, when they said, oh, I had a different therapist every year. Well, that's what we call continuity of care. Providing a therapist each year such that a child has to, or a young person has to tell their story over and over and over again is in some ways, well, uncaring at one level, but also ineffective at another.
But before young people even enter this system or start seeing therapists, often the most important first responders are family members. At the forum, young people from Chinese, Indian, and Filipino backgrounds explained how their depression wasn't culturally accepted. 23-year-old Amber Cavarles said her depression started when her mother died from cancer and her brother began attempting suicide. But talking about hardship or emotions just wasn't part of her Filipino culture. Instead of talking about it, she said, they lit candles at church. So she turned to the internet.
Google stuff like, how do you get colon cancer? You know, like, well, my mom died from it, now what? And just like any self-diagnosing type of thing without a doctor or professional, you start to self-blame, and because you're getting information from an outside source that doesn't know your personal story.
Some families present at the forum were looking for ways to recognize symptoms so that they could seek help.
My daughter is a frequent procrastinator. And recently she told me that her procrastination is due to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Will ADHD lead to depression in the long run?
Great question.
The forum's key message was that depression is a treatable illness. While it might be treatable, the youth panelists reiterated that it doesn't feel curable. With so much knowledge surrounding depression, it's hard to believe that painful stigmas still present an issue for so many cultures. Hopefully, this forum was just the beginning of many conversations that can change the way people view depression. For Cross Currents, I'm Raphael Johns.
You can find more Youth Radio pieces at our website. It's kalw.org. And speaking of youth, the teenage years can be full of angst. One way to overcome the trials and tribulations of being a teenager is finding a creative outlet. 18-year-old Tatiana Martinez turned to writing poetry as a young girl to cope with big changes in her life. Over time, her poetry evolved into music. She now works for the recording studio Upstar Records inside of San Francisco's Sunset Youth Services. It's run by young people and supports them with things like parenting classes, food assistance, and job training. When Martinez isn't helping young musicians make music, she writes and records her own songs with the goal of putting out her own album. She shares the story behind her songs in this installment of Bay Area Beats.
Keep your head up.
My music has a very old-school West Coast flavor to it. Like, everybody tells me I sound like back in the 90s before I was born.
Trying to grind to make that money. Always bought that action, always popping guns, dropping bodies, buying a brick just to sell. His mama really sick, the circumstances ain't well.
Actually finishing this song, Consequences, I'm very proud of that because it was something I did very quick and I didn't want to... When I make music, I'm not always in a rush to record it because at a point I will record it, but this song, Consequences, is like, I feel like it needs to be out.
And that he'll be there forever as long as he knows all he really hopes.
My favorite part is the writing, because that's the part where it's fun for me because it's the part where I'm crossing out words, I'm putting back words, I'm fixing my lines, I'm timing where I have to start, my chorus.
That's how it goes. I know times get hard, but even though you may lose your hope, just know life ain't over, baby, just keep your head.
I started writing poetry because my brother went to jail, and the only way I could feel that I could express it was through poetry. He went to jail when he was like 18 or 17. I was in sixth grade. It impacted me in a big way because my father not being around and my brother practically took that place. But now not having that person that I can call whenever, it did really change it. It taught me not to like take life like everything you do has a consequence. That's what he practically taught me.
My worst fear is the thought of losing you. Every time we fuss and fight, I can't help it, so I cry. Thinking about the past, how we was when we started. I done made it clear to you, so what else can I do?
All my songs are probably going to be stories, whether they're mine or not, but they're stories about how it is hard at school and the struggle can be hard and how you can feel alone sometimes. And then it goes to circumstances at home, how it is different living, because I've lived in a house before with a lot of my family and I also lived in projects. So that's a big difference. And I want people to be able to relate that, even though some people look at me and say like, okay, well, she has this and that. Like, I want to let people know, like, it's not always has been like that. There's been times where I've been at my lowest and at my highest.
Tell me what you gonna do. Am I on your mind? Do you miss me too?
My hardest times was from 8th grade to probably 10th. I lived in L.A. From the age of 7 to 14. Those were the years where my brother had went to jail and my mom had got really sick. And I was a little rebel at the time. I didn't really think about school as a big deal. I didn't care for it at all. And going to school and the teachers just, as soon as I get there, like, you're late, get out. It was really hard. Like, I didn't care whatsoever. I wouldn't mind. For me, it was a prize going home. and I moved back to San Francisco. So I felt like coming to San Francisco was an opportunity to start over. They don't know who I am. So it was a big change for me. Everything went better. I'm a straight-A student now. I'm very concentrated with music. After high school, I know I want to go to college and I really want to pursue music and make my own major on music.
Yeah, I'm single for the night. Yeah, I'm single. Yeah, I'm single. Yeah, I'm single. Yeah, I'm single for the night.
A lot of things I would get is that I'm a girl and that music is going to be like hard for a girl to get into rapping. Most of all because I'm not interested as much to singing as rapping. Me is all rap. So they would tell me it'd be hard, but I don't know. I saw that more as a motivation when people would tell me that. I never saw it as, oh, I'm going to stop, or not everybody's going to like what I do. And if one person doesn't like it, three more will.
Now tell me what you want, and I'll tell you it's all right. Don't play any games if you don't want to see a player. This lady right here, keep it real, she ain't no hater. I hope you understand what I'm really trying to say. I got my red.
That's San Francisco artist Tatiana Martinez. Her story was produced by KALW's Audrey Dilling. To find out how you can get your hands on more of Martinez's music, go to KALW.org. That's also where you can hear more Bay Area beats from Upstar Records at Sunset Youth Services. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Isabel Angel, Ninigen Sodebs, Lawrence Chan, Audrey Dilling, Sandia Dirks, Jeannie Dwan, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Suki Lewis, Ted Muldoon, Ryan Miller, Judy Silber, Stephen Short, Liza Veal, and Melanie Young. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Our line producer is Leela Day. Our senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Tune in to Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll consider the options for eliminating all of San Francisco's waste.
Keeping food out of compost and donating it to feed hungry people is way more and better than turning it into dirt.
Checking in on the Zero Waste 2020 plan. That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. It's summertime. That's a perfect time to experience the sunny sounds of the Corner Laughers, who you're hearing now. The Corner Laughers from Redwood City have an afternoon show planned on Sunday at the Public Library in Mill Valley. Music starts about 11 a.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.
Into many miles, followed in your footsteps from the train station toll. And I could see us on Midsummer's Day, in circles heralded by stars. And I could cast us in a mother's play.
This is Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Each week, we'll play you a sound recorded somewhere in the Bay Area. Ready? Here we go.
So some of the things that the judges are looking for are like a droopy tail, a severe underbite goes a long way.
Can you identify what that was and where we recorded it? Call 415-264-7106 and tell us. And then let us know where we should record next. We'll tell you the story behind the sound every Thursday night on Cross Currents, so tune in. What's the sound of where you live? Call 415-264-7106.